Executive Counselor Chris Nunu, welcome to Morning Edition.
Thanks for having me.
As head of Waterville Valley Ski Resort, you have a unique perspective on issues facing the economy in the northern part of the state. But the North Country continues to stagnate, and people there will be looking to the next governor to help turn things around. So what do you think is missing in the North Country? What needs to be done?
Snow. Snow is missing in the North Country. Look, you're absolutely right. We've had a tough year up there. You know, one of the reasons I'm running for governor is because I believe you need a governor with a true regional perspective. It's not just about what happens in the southern part of the state or Manchester, the western part, seacoast over where I live. And my business is up in the North Country. So things are very different. For example, if you're on the seacoast, things are going pretty well in terms of you see a lot of development up there. North of Concord, a whole different story. I have 800 employees at Waterville Valley. That's a big responsibility that I take. We've been fortunate in that I think we've had a great management team up there. We're the only mountain right now expanding our mountain on the entire East Coast. We're going to have a new lift and 10 new trails. But not everyone was as fortunate. You can look at the snowmobiling groups, the cross-country groups, the mom and pops. Those guys had to expend all their savings and capital this past winter, which has really caused a stagnation. Now, this summer's been okay, but all of our available capital was used on operations last year in terms of the North Country as a whole. It's not just about driving more tourism dollars. I mean, that's obviously a big part of it. But we need a governor that appreciates the dynamics in the North Country, what people are facing, and how to turn it around. And there has to be an emphasis on it to be sure.
How do you attract businesses to it?
Well, look, we got to attract businesses to the entire state. A big thing with me is infrastructure. You know, we need to focus on making sure our roads and bridges are where they need to be when you have I-93 unfinished. 2,000 miles of roads, primarily in the North Country, that are poor or very poor condition, as they're classified. 153 red-listed bridges. I mean, for goodness sakes, even on the seacoast, the Sarralong Bridge broke last week. I mean, literally broke. So infrastructure is really the heart of making sure we can get people to the North Country. And then again, providing them opportunities, breaking down some of the regulatory barriers that some of those businesses have. So when they do want to expand, when they do want to invest their capital, they're not caught in a legal quagmire for 18 months. They can do it quickly. They can do it easily. I'm a big believer, and maybe it's, again, because of my business experience, we've lost a sense of quality customer service. We've made things very difficult, people, whether it's trying to get signed up for Medicaid or whether it's trying to break down the regulatory barriers of expanding your business or doing something with permitting. We've made it so even small businesses have to hire $30,000 in lawyers to figure out how to do the paperwork. That's not the New Hampshire way. I'm trying to bring good New Hampshire values and reinstill that sense of local control so we can be nimble, we can be quick, we can make good decisions and allow the businesses and individuals to make the best decisions for themselves and really move forward.
Okay, so I think I hear you saying get rid of a lot of the red tape in way of regulation.
Yeah.
But when you talk about some of the jobs that you could create now, you talk about having 800 employees, of course, in season, in peak season, but some of those jobs seasonal, part-time, and
so on. Oh, yeah.
You know, that's, I think, a real issue for a lot of tourist areas is good jobs, year-round jobs, jobs that would have potential for, you know, moving up and for benefits.
So, again, we have a workforce problem in the state. We have especially in the North Country, we have a tough time hiring good people because a lot of the young folks are moving out of state, right? They're looking for and finding better economic opportunity out of state. We need workforce investment programs. For example, even if you take it out of tourism and you look at nursing, we have a massive nursing shortage. We're going to have a teacher shortage in the next couple of years here. We have a shortage in psychiatry, clinicians, folks that work at our recovery centers, which are really important. My program looks at creating business tax incentives, for example, on the back end of a recovery center. So again, we have folks we deal with Waterville within our employee base that have substance abuse issues, and we try to do our own peer-to-peer recovery and some other things like that. We need to make investments to get a lot of the able-bodied working adults that are out there but not currently in the workforce back into the workforce. So again, the state has to help provide that gateway, if you will. My program also looks at if you go to a university here in New Hampshire, we have very high student debt, right? A lot of the folks are leaving the state because they have to pay off this debt. My program says if you stay and work in the state in one of those high-demand job areas, we'll help pay down that student debt, right? So it's kind of 1 + 1 = 5. Let's help retain our workforce, create an incentive, provide businesses with more of a workforce to tap into, help students pay down student debt, and help people actually stay here in New Hampshire so they can establish those roots and start raising a family here.
I'm going to stay with the North Country for just a moment and ask you, I know you believe the Northern Pass Project should happen. You've stated that, but there's been criticism about a lack of transparency with that project. Are there concerns valid?
Well, I think, I think there were early on, without a doubt. When Hydro-Québec was driving that project, I had a lot of concerns about it. I could never get a straight story out of them. In the past couple of years, Eversource has taken a more of a direct and lead role on it. I give them credit in that I think they've started working much closer with the individual towns, with the individual businesses, explaining what the benefits are. The fact that they were willing to bury 60 more miles of line last year, the fact that they agreed to a 10% power purchase agreement. Frankly, we use less than 10% of the power, the New England power here in New Hampshire, so I thought that was a very fair and reasonable expectation of theirs. They are clearly doing things on their part to try to get this thing done. I think as it moves through what we call the Site Evaluation Committee at the Public Utilities Commission, as we go through that, the plan may change a little more, which is fine, but it really should get done. I'm one of the highest energy users in the state. My electric bill, you might have heard me talk about it before. 2 years ago, my electric bill was $1.2 million just to make snow. That is unsustainable. So when I see manufacturers doing expansion projects or even leaving the state altogether, BAE, Ruger, Foss, all these companies that have left the state or are doing expansion out of the state, I understand. I'm on the front lines of those issues just like they are. I'm a stakeholder in energy. I'm a stakeholder in our high healthcare costs. I'm a stakeholder in our high business taxes or regulatory environment. I live and breathe those issues every single day like those businesses are. That's what we need in the corner office, a governor that understands these issues from a first-order perspective. So when we're making these policy decisions, we really have an understanding of how it's going to impact people's lives. At the end of the day, you have to understand whatever we do in Concord, it's about the people. It's about the individuals, the families. How are they benefiting, or what are the unintended consequences that are coming upon them? The only way to make those best decisions is to have a stakeholder in the governor's office.
Let's talk about some consequences when it comes to the future of the state's Medicaid expansion program. You said that you don't want to kick the nearly 50,000 people that are now enrolled off those health care services, but you also don't want to spend taxpayer dollars to keep the program going. So what would be your plan?
So right now we've extended the program 2 years without providing additional tax burden directly to the state taxpayers here in New Hampshire. We have what we call it's 5 or 7% that the private sector is picking up to defer those costs. As we move forward, the federal government is going to pay less and less and less, which is going to put more pressure on the state to pay more and more. At some point, we just can't necessarily expect the private sector to always be picking up that cost, maybe a portion of it to be sure. So whatever we do has to be long-term. It has to be sustainable. One of the frustrations I have in my experience as the executive counselor is we do a lot of things in the state in two-year chunks, right? Because that's the election cycle. That's not long-term planning. That isn't necessarily making the best decisions for the state in the long term. In my business, in my family, we think long-term, 3, 5, 10 years down the road. You have to make those best decisions. We don't have that, and that's another aspect of what I want to bring here. When it comes to expanded Medicaid, I've said I would not just cut 45, 50,000 people off the expanded Medicaid rolls on day one. That's not a good idea. My plan was to what I call grandfather them out, bring the eligibility requirements more in line with the traditional Medicaid program. And as people get back into the workforce onto private plans, you don't necessarily let them back in under those same eligibility requirements. So we don't kick them out. They just kind of grandfather themselves out. And over time, the system
caps
comes.
Caps here to here?
Yeah. And I wouldn't necessarily say caps, but as they get out of the system, we change those requirements so the same people can't come right back into it. So it's not kicking them off the system. It's getting them back into the private sector healthcare, which is a good thing. The fundamental problem with all of this, if I may, is that in our state over the past 4, 5, 6 years, we've incentivized people to go to public plans, whether it's the healthcare exchange, expanded Medicaid. So we have high healthcare costs here because we don't have a lot of competition. How are we going to drive competition in healthcare in a state that is constantly incentivizing more people into public plans? It doesn't make sense. So we need to fundamentally change how we do it. We need a governor that understands what drives healthcare costs and create a more competitive environment for private healthcare that'll drop costs.
We've talked to many of your competitors this week that have, if I may, to many of your competitors this week that have basically said, not in so many words, they want a work requirement.
Yeah, I would love to see a work requirement. And you know why? The work requirement is very simple. It means volunteering at a nonprofit. It means going out and maybe just trying to look for a job or get interviews or, you know, some basic part-time work. It's a very simple work requirement. You know, we backed off from doing that because we were afraid the federal government would say no, because we don't have a governor that's willing to stand up and fight for what's in the best interest of New Hampshire. You'll never convince me that Washington, D.C. ever has New Hampshire's best interest in mind. Ever. They don't. There's really no debate about that. They're looking out for the 330 million or whatever it is Americans out there. And frankly, we do things different in New Hampshire. When we do it our way, we do it better than everybody else. I believe that very strongly in my heart. I have a lot of passion about that. You know, if we want to look at continuing this expanded Medicaid or how we're going to do it, you know, my message to the federal government is you give us the money. Let us design a system for our people, for our state, for our individuals, knowing the dynamics that we have. What happens in New Hampshire is a heck of a lot different than California, New York, and Mississippi. So let's get back to basics, reinstill local control, kick Washington bureaucracy out of here, and do it the right way. Do it the New Hampshire way.
I want to move on to the heroin and opioid crisis. You've been vocal in your criticism of state and local leaders on this issue. So what would you do differently?
Well, first, again, you're right. I've been very critical of the governor. I think the governor has been completely absent on this issue. Her drug czar was a disaster. I was calling for his resignation pretty much before the guy was hired back in 2014. It was political at best, and the governor was completely absent. He finally resigned back in January. I think the current drug czar, Jim Vera, is doing a pretty good job. His first day on the job, I took him and we toured the Farnham Center together because I said, you got to get on the front lines of this. There is money sitting in Concord that is unspent on this issue. That's frustrating, right? We have a lot of good programs in this state that could benefit from additional dollars. They're having success.
Why is that money unspent?
Let me give you a quick example. Teen Challenge. Teen Challenge is a program in Manchester with a great success rate of recovery, right? But you know what? They're faith-based. And because of that, they don't participate in public dollars. Why? If you're having a success, I don't care whether you're faith-based or not or what your program is. If we're having programs with success, let's support those. Let's champion those. But we've created a bureaucratic system that excludes certain people or that allows politics to come into play and favoritism to come into play when, frankly, there's nothing political about this crisis. It affects everyone, every city, every town. And I have been critical of a lack of local leadership. There are some local elected officials who have been difficult to work with, who I think have been a little bit asleep at the wheel and late to the game in terms of addressing this issue. I won't name the town, but I was working with a town in the southern part of the state, for example. Let me back up a little bit. Charlie Baker, I think, has done some great stuff in Massachusetts in terms of helping break down some of the local barriers and regulations and getting some of these recovery centers built. We need more beds. We know that. And I sat with some town officials that said, well, we don't really want a recovery center here. That's not the problem we want in our town. You have that problem in your town. You have that crisis. Let's be part of the solution. That's where my frustration comes from. My experience working with some local officials who, you know, are hesitant to make those big leaps forward. I'm going to be a governor that doesn't go in and just bullies people around and doesn't force things, but it champions good projects and uses the leverage of the state to get good projects done and dollars out where they can be successful. I think we've done a good job, not a great job, not our best job. And my biggest frustration is local elected officials or state elected officials who try to claim we're winning this war on drugs, we're having success. There are some small programs that have success, no doubt, and that's wonderful. But we are losing this war on drugs. Let's make no mistake about it. We need someone that's going to fight hard, make sure law enforcement is supported with the funds and resources they need. Look, we have a problem hiring cops right now. We really do. We have a recruitment issue in this state. I want to make sure that that isn't an issue. I want to make sure that we're not limiting the ability of law enforcement to make arrests where they need to be made with the drug dealers and being forceful with the penalties on them. I want to champion the drug courts. I think that's a great step that the state started to take last year. We need to do more. So again, we're not just putting addicts in jail. Addiction is not a crime, but we can get some of these kids into recovery programs that work, get the dollars out there that need to be spent, and make sure all the programs that have potential to be successful in the state have a seat at the table to vie for those funds and really move forward on those programs.
You've received some criticism from members of your own party for your vote earlier this year in favor of the state contract with Planned Parenthood of Northern New England. Now, that was a contract that you voted against last year. So how do you explain your change of heart to some Republican primary voters?
No, so let's be clear. I have voted I voted for that contract in the past. I would never support taxpayer funding of abortions. No Republican, and I think there's very few Democrats that actually even support that. And I don't support that. This is about health care for women and families. In my district, this contract came before us. It was the absolute only choice that we had this year. The only choice. I called other facilities, health care providers, to bid. They wouldn't do it for a variety of different reasons.
But you voted against it last year because...
Last year, they were under investigation, but 10 separate state investigations because of those videos that we saw. And I thought the videos were disgusting. They were deplorable. There were legal investigations going on in states, I think even one in the federal government, that were outstanding. To date, all those investigations over those videos are gone. They've been debunked. There was nothing illegal. So there's no reason to move forward. I don't care whether you're a snowplow driver or a healthcare provider. If you have 10 pending legal investigations against you, I don't think we should necessarily be doing business. So I said, let's take a pause. Let's find out what the real story is. We did. That was prudent and right. It's been cleared up. Now we're moving forward. In my district, it's the only option, and I'm not going to stand. You're right. I took a lot of heat from some other Republicans about it. But when you are an elected official in the state, there's a sense of there is a matter of public trust. And the public trust says, I'm going to cast my vote with my constituents in mind every single time. It doesn't matter how it affects me, my political future, any of that, because I know all that is potentially, quote unquote, at risk. My job is to take care of my constituents. It's how I've cast every single vote as an executive counselor, and it's exactly what I'm going to do as governor.
Many Republicans, though, and probably you could say a vast majority in many places, are against Planned Parenthood in principle. Do you think that those criticisms are unfounded?
Well, no, I'm not going to challenge people's belief or agreement with a group or what they do. This contract is not about Planned Parenthood. It's about health care. It's a health care contract. And keep in mind, this is the exact same contract every conservative governor over the last 40 years has approved. Governor Sununu approved it 3 times, Governor Merrill twice, Governor Gregg twice, Governor Benson. They all approved the exact same contract with Planned Parenthood for the exact same services. Why? Because it's about people, not politics. It's about the services they provide, not about, we might not agree necessarily with the abortion aspect of their business. A lot of people might not. That's fine. But this is about health care. And I'm not going to put my politics in the way of getting my constituents the best services they can. These are low-income women that do not have other insurance options right now. They're not on the exchange. They've kind of fallen through the cracks on expanded Medicaid. These are people that can take advantage. And it's not just women, by the way. It's families. It's men. I've been to the center. I've talked to the people who participate in these funds. And it's a good program. Planned Parenthood was the only option, and that's what we did.
I want to move on to education. We saw the courts rule this week that the state's cap on education aid to cities and towns is unconstitutional. You've talked about the need for a constitutional amendment to give the legislature more control on the issue, as many of your competitors in this race have. But we all know that's been a tough sell over the years. And what's your plan? What's your backup
plan? It's a tough sell because we haven't had the right governor to sell it. Let me give credit to Governor Lynch. He tried to do it. I want to say it was 2008 or 2009. I might get the year wrong there. He couldn't get the Democrats to go along with him on it. It was the right thing to do. He couldn't get it done. He didn't, for the most popular governor in the state's history, to not be able to get that done. He wasn't willing to put his real capital behind it, if you will. I am, and I'll tell you why. It's not about the politics. It's about restoring local control. It's about restoring power of the purse to the legislature, because that's where the power of the people is in this state, and that's a great thing. Let the legislature, our elected representatives, make the best decisions for our local communities.
But in lieu of not being able to get that done, especially talking about maybe in a 2-year term, what do you do? Is there a backup plan?
The backup plan is you keep fighting to get it done, because the backup plan right now with the power of the purse in the courts isn't viable. That's not a good solution. That's not the New Hampshire way. The court shouldn't be deciding where we cast our money for funds. I'm a big believer, for example, I'm going to go a little off tangent, but school building aid, for example, right? We need to make sure we reinstill school building aid back in the state budget. I'm a big believer in it. You're not going to have much success sending kids to schools that are falling apart. Some districts are fine. Some districts are not. Again, I'm up in the North Country quite a bit, and in the western part of the state. Some of those school districts need some help, and we can provide it, and we should.
How do we provide it? Where do we find that funding?
Well, the funding's there. Look, I'm a big believer that you don't need more money in the state, but you do need a governor that knows how to allocate and prioritize. I think we have our priorities wrong in a lot of things in education. Look, I have a fifth grader and a sixth grader. I'm very passionate about education, not because I read the talking points on a piece of paper. I'm in my kids' classrooms, right? You want to know why I'm so adamant that we need to scrap Common Core? Because I see it. When my son came home to me last year and told me he practiced for the Smarter Balance test 20-plus straight days, practice for the test. There's nothing educational about that. And the teachers are frustrated. We need to take those invisible handcuffs off the teachers. Let them do what they do best. Provide quality, individualized education. Have the time to do it. Maybe it can they can challenge a student that needs to be challenged a little more, give a little extra help to a student who could be helped a little more. But we've put all this pressure, money, and emphasis on, frankly, things that are not in our best interest and in our classrooms. And it comes from Washington, D.C. No place in this state does Washington, D.C. bureaucracy interfere with our lives as much as in our classrooms. And I say that as a dad.
But so are you saying you could channel some money that goes to curriculum to building aid or other educational funding? I mean, how do you move those pieces
around? It's a misallocation of funds, absolutely. Yeah. So it's not just about
what
building aid.
What can you as a governor do to change that?
Of course, we create the budget. And we can push back on the federal government and say, look, if you want these programs to go forward, we're going to do it our way. You can send us the money because, frankly, it's our money. We are the taxpayers. But we're going to control how that money gets spent, where it gets directed. And just because the federal government is supporting, you know, 5 or 10%, whatever it is, of our education, and that's hundreds of millions of dollars, by the way, which can have huge impacts, doesn't mean that they should be setting all the rules in our classrooms. Those rules need to be set not even by the governor, not by the legislature, by the parents, the teachers, and the local community. Let's get local restoration of our control of our classrooms back to the locals where it belongs.
Now, you said earlier in the campaign at one point, quote, you'd got the Board of Education. What did you mean by that?
Well, look, I've been very disappointed by the board. There's no doubt about it. I've even voted for some of those members, and they've disappointed me with their votes. They're very pro-Common Core. They don't seem to have the will to stand up for the individuals. I think they've lost sight of what is important to parents and teachers in the local classrooms, and they're just deferring to the governor, who defers to the federal government. So essentially, I believe our Board of Education in the state, which is a very powerful board, by the way, has gotten lax, and they defer to the federal government, which again never has New Hampshire's best interest in mind. I want a Board of Education. We have great qualified people out there that can get on that board, understands what's happening in the classrooms, and make the best decision for them. It's about people. It's not about politics.
Let's shift gears a bit. On the issue of Syrian refugees, you've said the U.S. should halt resettlement until government can 100% guarantee they aren't terrorists. How do you do that?
It's not how we do it. It's how the federal government does it. I mean, that's if Barack Obama and the Homeland Security is going to just let all these immigrants flood into the country, well, let's have a vetting process. Let's know what's coming in. It's a safety issue. And we've seen what happened in Europe when they let that happen in Europe. There's a lot of problems over
there.
But
to be clear, our vetting process here is not like what's been happening in Europe. We do have a vetting process that in some cases has taken up to 2 years for many refugees to come.
Yeah, but there's still a lot we don't know. There have been refugees that have come into this country where we know very little more than their name. I mean, that's a fact. And so I've said, look, we don't get to pick and choose which ones come to the state of New Hampshire. They literally get put on a plane somewhere, whether it's in Washington or somewhere, and sent up here with a few bucks to take care of them.
You're saying that we only know their name, but you're saying the federal government only knows their name?
There are times when the federal government knows very little about their background, what their background is, what their motives are, what their intentions are. The vetting process at the federal level is weak. And we're talking about a safety issue for the people of New Hampshire. I'm not just going to sit back and say thank you very much to the federal government until they start doing their job.
You were endorsed recently by Ohio Governor John Kasich, someone who's been openly critical of Donald Trump, the Republican presidential nominee. You said you support Trump.
I do.
But when Republicans like Kasich say that they can't get behind him, does that give you any pause at all?
No, look. Governor Kasich has his own relationship with Mr. Trump. I'm hopeful Governor Kasich might come around and get on board. I think it's important. The alternative to me with Hillary Clinton was disastrous. And there's two words: public trust. You may not like some of the things Donald Trump says. I've taken exception with a lot of things that he says. But when you look at Hillary Clinton, when you look at the alternative, public trust, there is none. There is none right there. And that is what I think, and growing up in New Hampshire, where public service is important to all of us, whether you're, you know, helping out on the planning board or running for governor, we all participate in public service. And I grew up in a family where public trust is first and foremost. You have to be transparent. You have to be accessible. There has to be checks and balances. You can't be abusing the power of your office for personal gain. And there is a lot of issues, whether you talk about Benghazi or the emails or what the using her office to raise money for her own foundation. Look, it's all out there. I don't need to reiterate all that. That is all an issue of pure public trust that I have no trust in with her. I'm absolutely going to support Donald Trump.
When you talk about trust, though, there have been many statements by Donald Trump, many contradictory statements throughout the course of the campaign. You have no trust issues when it comes to Trump?
No, not in terms of the public discord. Look, has Donald Trump, you know, said certain things here and certain things there that, you know, that kind of have to be arranged in terms of where the policy really is? We're not talking about policy issues with Hillary Clinton. We're talking about character. We're talking about principles. These are things that are critical parts of leadership. I believe that. I know that in running my business at Waterville and taking care of my family. You have to have character, principles, and leadership values. Those are very important. She would be a terrible example for the children, for the businesses, for the individuals of this country in terms of being trustworthy, in terms of being transparent, and knowing where we're going.
And you feel that Donald Trump has been trustworthy and transparent in his campaign?
I believe he will be a trustworthy and transparent president.
But has he been trustworthy during his campaign?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I'm. If you're referring to certain statements, we can talk about those. But I don't. I do not have concerns. Yes.
Okay. Executive Counselor Chris Sununu, thank you for the time.
Thank you. Always great to be here.